Was he slow?
No.
Good kid. Devil behind the wheel. Was he slow? Retarded means slow. Was he slow?
No.
What the hell else more do you need to know? Devil behind the wheel. Retarded means slow. Was he slow?
We are Film Bookcast. We're here to make you think about movies and get sad and stuff.
God damn it.
This is the official podcast of filmbook.com.
Wow, Mike.
I'm Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a man who's trying to complete a pub crawl that will most assuredly end in total annihilation.
Mike DeCruz, yeah.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good. I'm here to applaud you for your amazing Scott Pilgrim deep cut. Well done.
Thank you. Oh, it's actual applause. yeah, if you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news and then move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we're going to move right on into our featured review. This week is the newest film from director Edgar Wright, Baby Driver. That's why I made a Scott Pilgrim and a The World's End reference in that... in that thing, because I love Edgar Wright. I'm just super excited to celebrate his work in this episode. Mike, are you excited to talk about Baby Driver?
Yes. Yes. I almost spoiled my review, but yes.
Yeah, definitely. But before we can get into any of that, Mike, we have to get into some film news.
Hi! It's time for...
What?
It's time for... It's time for...
Film news!
Hi! It's time for...
What?
All right, it's time for our film news here on Film Bookcast, and we begin with an update from some news that we reported last week. Last week, we reported that Netflix has canceled two of its biggest shows, The Get Down and Sense8, and I was very upset about the cancellation of Sense8. I still haven't had the chance to watch Season 2 yet, which just premiered, I think, in May, but I am eager to watch it at some point because I do love the Wachowskis, and Season 1 was really, really great. But Netflix canceled it, so everybody was like up in the air because apparently Season 2 ends on kind of a cliffhanger. And so everybody was very upset. Now Netflix and Lana Wachowski have said that Sense8 is getting a 2-hour wrap-up special, which will air in 2018. So I wanted to mention that to placate all these Sense8 fans who get all of their news from Film Bookcast. That's
yeah, all of the people that listen to only us for their film news.
Yeah, there is a Venn diagram of people who watch Sense8, people who listen to Film Bookcast, and there is the circle, like the circles cross, and there's like one guy in that circle, and it's probably me.
I think there is an interesting thing here where Netflix, you know, by the virtue of what we always talk about you know, their distribution and production of their own content, that they can get a final series wrap up special to have, like, that's a thing that can happen. I don't know if that's ever happened really before on a network.
I mean, HBO does that occasionally and stuff like that. Like, if they want to wrap up their shows, they'll. Usually, what's interesting about this is that Netflix canceled Sense8, and then like fan reaction, fan outcry was so huge that Netflix was like, "Oh, well, maybe we should just do something to placate them," because that's basically all they're in the business of doing.
Yeah, I think that's what I meant.
Yeah, because I think HBO has done that a few times. I think like Hello Ladies had like a season wrap up. I think there was talk of Deadwood getting one, and that never really happens. I'm positive there are examples of. Like a wrap-up movie or a wrap-up episode that...
After the fact, after it's been canceled, and people were like, okay, yeah, we'll make one more for you guys.
Yeah, or they'll act like the season... Like, they'll do, like, a shortened season rather than...
Right.
I think that's usually what HBO does. It's like, if they know they want to cancel something, but they don't want the angry fan reactions, they will do, like, you know, a shorter, like, 3-episode season or something, as opposed to
right.
a whole season or something like that, just to wrap things up. But yeah, I think this is interesting. It's interesting to me that Netflix didn't do this right from the beginning to say like, hey, this is what we're doing instead of, because they had to understand that people were going to be upset about this.
Yeah.
Right?
Maybe they planned it as like a cool guy PR move. Like, we'll cancel the show. People will be pissed. And then we'll announce the thing we have planned already.
That is quite possible.
Maybe. I don't know.
Maybe. But in any case, I'm excited that it's getting a wrap-up finale, and I am eager to watch Season 2 at some point whenever I get the chance, because the Wachowskis are the best. Love the Wachowskis. I think they make really great stuff. And hopefully, my silver lining here is that hopefully this frees up the Wachowskis to do some more movies, which Would always be nice. So I wanted to mention that as an update to one of our stories last week. And I also wanted to mention this, that Michael Nyqvist, the star of the Swedish Girl with the Dragon Tattoo movies, and he was also the villain of Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol and John Wick, died a couple weeks ago. And I just wanted to mention that. R.I.P. Michael Nyqvist. He was great in John Wick. That's really the role that I associate him with. I remember he was in Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, but he's such like – he's so underused in that movie. You know, mm-hmm. like I barely remember him being in it, but then I remember him being in John Wick and be like, wow, how did they not use this guy in Ghost Protocol? Because he's a great foil for John Wick in that movie.
He has one of the best one word deliveries, I think, in movie history. When John Leguizamo says he killed John Wick's dog, and his character just responds, oh, and hangs up the phone. It's amazing. It says so much about like that whole. You know, we don't need to praise John Wick more than we do all the time, right. But it's to his credit.
Yeah, and he gets a lot of the explaining of who John Wick is, and that's a lot of like fun dialogue for him to like chew into. There's a lot of scenery chewing there. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to say R.I.P. Michael Nyqvist because that's a bummer for sure. But then now let's move on, Mike. Let's get into the actual film news that we have for today. Damon Lindelof, creator of Lost and creator of The Leftovers, is now developing a Watchmen TV series for HBO.
What a crazy sentence. Which seems to just be in character for Damon Lindelof at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would assume this is probably like a miniseries. There's not really a ton of details about this yet. But Watchmen is a pretty finite comic. Like, it's a 12-issue thing. But then again, who knows? Like, The Leftovers they finished that whole book in season one, and there was two more seasons after that.
Right.
And they were the best seasons. So... Not that season one wasn't great, because it was, but season two of Leftovers is like primo stuff, and so is season three.
Yeah.
So I am surprised that this is the direction that Damon Lindelof is taking, because basically now that The Leftovers is done, you know, I feel like he had so much critical acclaim after The Leftovers. Like, it sort of redeemed him in the eyes of a lot of people, because a lot of people were very unsatisfied with Lost. But I feel like this is an interesting step for his career. I also think this is a little weird. We had a Watchmen movie. You know, we had Zack Snyder's Watchmen from 2009, and I feel like that's a definitive, like, visual take on the material. If you watch that movie and you read the comic, like, it looks exactly like the comic.
Right.
So I'm interested to see what Lindelof could bring, if he can bring something new to it. But after The Leftovers, like, I'm in for for anything he does.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see. I feel like, you did point out the movie is kind of a definitive version of it, I guess, in some way, but Watchmen as a property, like as a piece of fiction, is so fucking weird. So I'm down for Lindelof's take on extrapolating that Dr. Manhattan is a god, basically. Like, right. Give me some weird stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm definitely into that idea of Damon Lindelof's Watchmen. And then there is some pretty major news on the acting front. Daniel Day-Lewis, one of the most acclaimed actors of all time, like one of the greats. Like, inarguably, one of the best actors like ever, pretty much, is saying that he is officially retiring from acting. He's ending his acting career, and that Paul Thomas Anderson's next movie, Phantom Thread, is the current title of that movie, will be his last film. Supposedly, that's coming out around December. And this happened once before. Danny Day-Lewis actually said in the 90s that he was retiring from acting. And he spent his time, and he did retire from acting for a while, spent some time as a shoe cobbler. That's seriously what he did. He ended up being a shoe cobbler for a couple of years, and then Martin Scorsese convinced him to return to acting for Gangs of New York. And supposedly, I think what I heard, this is, you know, the rumor mill churning, Daniel Day-Lewis is going to be a dressmaker now, after spending so much time, you know, method acting for Phantom Thread, which is what that movie's about. It's about a fashion designer.
Right.
That's kind of the route that he's going in. He's just going to stop acting and become a dressmaker, which is insane.
Sure. Daniel Day-Lewis is going to do what Daniel Day-Lewis wants, I guess.
Yeah, he will. Daniel Day-Lewis do what Day-Lewis does.
Right? Precisely. That's a thing.
That's a phrase that I just made up. It is. I think it is a bummer that he's retiring, but also, like, he only appears in, like, one movie every 5 years, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, they're the best movies of that those 5 years usually.
But I can't say this is like shocking news to me, just because I feel like every time Daniel Day-Lewis comes out with a movie, it's like, oh, this might be the last time I ever see Daniel Day-Lewis in a movie.
Yeah.
You know? Like, he could have stopped after Lincoln, and it would have made perfect sense. Like, that would have been it.
Yep.
I'm a little bummed that this is the movie that made him retire and not Lincoln. Like, if he just decided, I'm going to go be the president of the United States.
What a different world. In an alternate timeline, that's happened.
In the alternate timeline where Daniel Day-Lewis retires from acting because he got the president bug from being a Lincoln. Rather than the dressmaking bug from Phantom Thread. Like, man, that's quite a different timeline we would
leave. Yeah.
Isn't Dan DeLewis is Irish, right? Like, he was born in Ireland or something, or England. So I don't think
who knows. Who knows at this point?
He probably wouldn't be able to run for president, but also if anybody could circumvent that, be Dan DeLewis.
He would just run as Lincoln and we wouldn't even know.
Honestly, that's true. I remember watching Lincoln for the first time and never questioning for a second that I was actually watching Abraham Lincoln. he's that good. He's that good.
Yeah.
So I wanted to say that about Daniel Day-Lewis. Like, that's a bummer that he's retiring from acting, supposedly. You know,
for now.
For now. He'll do dressmaking for a couple of years and then probably come back with whatever Paul Thomas Anderson does next, which I'm sure will be amazing. I do think it will be pretty great if he becomes a dressmaker and starts designing dresses that, like, people at the Oscars end up wearing. And people will say, what are you wearing? And they're like, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Wow. That'd be wild.
That would be pretty nuts. Anyway, so wanted to mention that. R.I.P. Daniel Day-Lewis' acting career. And and then I want to move on to the big news, Mike. This is the huge news. Everyone was talking about this. Phil Lord and Chris Miller, two of my favorite filmmakers, were attached to make that young Han Solo movie for Star Wars. And they were deep in the throes of filming that movie. They've been filming that movie since January. There have been like 4 or 5 months of shooting happening on that young Han Solo movie. And with only a couple of weeks left of filming, Phil Lord and Chris Miller abruptly left the project. And there was so much confusion going around. Like, why did they leave? What happened? Like, what could possibly have made them leave? Did they leave of their own accord? Were they fired? Like, there was a whole big...
it was a Hollywood shakeup.
It was a Hollywood shakeup, a Hollywood shakedown of sorts. And yeah, so there's a whole lot of stuff going on with that. And then a couple days later, Ron Howard was announced as the replacement. And he's been filming the movie since then.
Right.
Which is also insane on its own. But yeah, so apparently what happened is that Phil Lord and Chris Miller's style clashed with Kathleen Kennedy and Lawrence Kasdan at every turn. Like, from the beginning. And to me...
That's so... Like, why hire them,
that's
then?
The thing. Like, that's the thing.
Like, what did you expect?
What did you expect? Like, hiring... I guess they expected to be able to control them more or whatever. And I guess their style of filming didn't... Like, it's not... I guess it wasn't, like, a bad style of filming. Like, it just didn't work with what they were doing. Like, Kathleen... Right. I guess Kathleen Kennedy and Lawrence Kasdan are used to a much more, like, professional, like, shooting space, so to speak. Like, you know, they have a certain amount of things they want to get done. They get them done. Whereas Phil and Chris Miller, they plan on, you know, kind of dicking around, kind of improvising a lot of scenes. And that works for them very well. All of their movies are great.
you know? Every one of them.
They've made 4 movies. All of them have been really good. And none of them should have been, you know? Like,
right.
Like, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs was a movie that was based on a 13-page book or whatever, you know? And
yeah.
21 Jump Street was the comedic reboot of an 80s TV show. And The Lego Movie was a movie about Legos. And, you know, 22 Jump Street was the sequel to a comedic reboot of an 80s TV show. Like, none of that stuff should have worked, right? And Phil and Chris Miller are so talented and so good at what they do that they made them work. And I feel like the movie that they were going to make probably could have been amazing. Like, the Han Solo movie that it was in my head that Lord and Miller were doing is really good and really entertaining. I think the movie will probably still turn out fine.
Yeah.
I think, you know, they might still have enough of their stamp on there that I might get, like, a glimpse of what I was hoping for. And Ron Howard's a guy who, I mean, I don't think he's made a movie I've liked since Frost Nixon in 2008. but he's a workman-like director. Like, he's the guy who gets in, is very professional, gets stuff done. He's very friendly, and, like, people will, you know, do their jobs and do them well, and he'll be on set and he'll deliver something for them and they'll be fine. But I feel like Lord Miller, like, they really missed their chance to do something really cool with Lord Miller in this situation. It's a similar situation to what happened with Rogue One. There was a whole thing about that in the backgrounds of that movie where Gareth Edwards was directing it. And then during the reshoots, Disney hired Tony Gilroy to kind of reshoot several aspects of the movie. And apparently, like, half of the movie was reshot. And Gareth Edwards kind of in the back seat, and Tony Gilroy kind of took over. So I think Disney wanted to do that again with this movie and get Lawrence Kasdan to direct. And Lawrence Kasdan's a great director, by the way. He directed, like, The Body Heat and The Big Chill, and, like, he wrote Empire Strikes Back and wrote Raiders of the Lost Ark. And so he has a huge pedigree, and he's a great director. And he is co-writing this movie. He co-wrote Force Awakens. And so I think they wanted him to come in as, like, oversee the project as a director, like, kind of reigning in Phil Lord and Chris Miller. And Lord and Miller said no. They stuck to their guns, and Disney fired them for it.
It's so silly. Like, I don't get it. It's one of the things we've been, you know, we were praising a lot of the Star Wars movies and franchises right now for getting these kind of weird indie directors, right, in some fashion. Not that Phil Lord and Chris Miller are indie directors, but, like, you know, Gareth Edwards, Rian Johnson is so... people with very unique visions.
Yeah.
And then apparently they're just hiring them and being like, nah, you got to fit into our mold, which is what they're doing for Marvel too, in some fashion.
Yeah.
We've heard.
I feel like Marvel, over the past couple of years has kind of escaped that and is, like, allowing, like, you know, Guardians 2 has filtered, like, James, just straight James Gunn.
Right? All the way. Yeah.
And, like, Thor 3 looks like straight Taika Waititi, and Ryan Coogler looks like he has a huge mark on Black Panther. So I feel like Marvel is moving away from that, because Marvel had, like, this creative committee that oversaw all their movies, and they disbanded that after the whole Edgar Wright debacle. Edgar Wright was attached to direct Ant-Man, and it was a highly publicized thing when he left Ant-Man. He was working on Ant-Man for, like, 8 years.
Yeah.
And then left, like, a few weeks before filming had started. And that was bad. Like, that seemed really bad for Marvel. And, you know, Ant-Man turned out pretty good. Like, I enjoyed Ant-Man. You liked it a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, That was a hugely bad PR situation for Marvel, and, you know, I feel like that was bad, like, him leaving a few weeks before filming. Phil and Chris Miller were almost done filming. Like, that's...
with a few weeks left, that might even be worse.
That's definitely worse, so I don't know. I am happy that Phil and Chris Miller kind of stuck to their guns and said, no, we don't want anybody to oversee us, and Disney retaliated and fired them for it. Hopefully they can jump onto something else pretty fast, because what more upsets me about this is not the fact that I'm missing out on a Phil Lord and Chris Miller Han Solo movie, although I'm definitely upset about that. I'm more upset they wasted their time making this Han Solo movie instead of making something else that I could have seen, you know, next year. You know?
Yeah.
So I'm hearing that The Flash over at DC is open for them to direct if they want it. So hopefully that happens, because I think they could do some really great things with The Flash. They did like a story treatment for The Flash a while back before they got attached to Han Solo, and then they ended up doing Han Solo. I also wouldn't say no to 23 Jump Street if that were the case. Like, you know, I would be into 23 Jump Street if they did it.
We'll finally get that. I didn't mean to.
Oh, were you gonna say the 23 Jump Street Men in Black crossover?
Yeah.
I would love that. I would also love it if they used it as an opportunity to make fun of this whole situation at Disney, because the Jump Street movies are super meta and super about the Hollywood business. And so I think
that
would be fantastic. So there's options, and, you know, maybe they'll do their own original thing. Who knows? Like, Edgar Wright leaving Ant-Man gave us Baby Driver. Right. So maybe it'll all turn out okay in the end.
they'll make Teen Driver.
They'll make Teen Driver. That sounds like a bad idea. And that's exactly what they do all the time. So
that's their wheelhouse. Yeah, exactly. That's
exactly their wheelhouse. But yeah, I mean, do you still want to see a Han Solo movie now that, you know, Phil and Chris Miller are gone? I feel like that was the main reason I was excited for the Han Solo movie.
Yeah, I think I still want to see it, just less so. Because, I mean, I think a Han Solo movie could be, you know, a young Han Solo movie could be fun, and probably will be. But without their signature silly, you know, action stuff that they always do, we're just now going to get a half of that and a half Ron Howard adventure movie, I guess.
A Ron Howard movie, yeah.
Yeah, so, sure. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, they were the reason I was excited for Han Solo, and they assembled a great cast for it. They got Alden Ehrenreich as Han Solo, and they got Donald Glover as Lando, which is insane, and Woody Harrelson's in it, and all that stuff. Apparently, Disney was not happy with Alden Ehrenreich's performance either, from what I'm hearing, and that might be because of Phil Lord and Chris Miller's direction of him. Like, they were directing him in a style that, you know, doesn't suit what Disney wanted with the movie or something, but apparently they hired an acting coach and everything. for him on the set of this movie. So I don't know, man. I don't.
Who knows what can happen?
Who knows what can happen? I think this is going to be interesting. I'm going to be interested to see what happens with episode 8. Apparently, Rian Johnson, they're really happy with Rian Johnson and what he's doing. So it might be a matter of hiring a unique voice like Rian Johnson or Phil and Chris Miller, but hiring somebody who can use that voice within the confines of what Disney wants.
Right.
Which I think is what Marvel was doing before, and now they're kind of just expanding to new, like, basically you can do whatever you want. You know, that was kind of like, you know, Joss Whedon's voice fit perfectly with what Marvel was doing with the Avengers movies kind of thing, you know?
So right.
They felt like Joss Whedon movies, they also felt like Marvel movies, and they kind of, like, had a pretty good thing going on together. Or, like, Shane Black was the perfect guy to do an Iron Man movie kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, who knows? Hopefully the Han Solo movie turns out good. Hopefully Phil and Chris Miller end up doing something really good, because those guys are the best and they deserve awesome stuff. They made the fucking Lego movie, man. It was like the most acclaimed movie of that year. Like, you know?
It's crazy. It's really crazy.
But yeah, I can't believe that Disney wouldn't just let them do their thing. But at the same time, I can totally believe it. It's upsetting.
Yeah.
But it makes total sense. So that wraps up our film news for today, Mike. Let's move on into our discussion.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for discussions on Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
So today, I don't know if you remember, Mike, it's been a while since I mentioned it, that I received a list of all these 70s and 80s fantasy movies, and I was going to do them all as my discussions for the foreseeable future, but then we fell off the track a little bit. Stuff happened. But I just today, for this episode, I decided to get back in, dive into this list, and my original plan was to watch three movies, but I only made it through two. Conan the Barbarian and Conan the Destroyer.
Okay.
I missed out on Red Sonja. Hopefully, we'll save that for next episode, maybe. But I just wanted to go through the Conan franchise and just see some silly, weird, schlocky 70s pulp fantasy. And I got exactly that. And I had seen Conan the Barbarian, so I knew going into that what to expect, and that is a big, dumb, fun, revenge, fantasy, sword and sorcery. Yeah, you know, I assume most people have seen Conan the Barbarian, but I had never seen Conan the Destroyer.
Okay.
Had you, Mike? Have you ever seen Conan the Destroyer?
I have not, actually, no.
Okay, so it is, you know, another Conan story. It's way dumber than Conan the Barbarian in terms of, like, scale. Like, Conan the Barbarian is this great revenge story, right? Him trying to avenge his family's death. Conan the Destroyer is literally, it's basically a D&D movie, which is amazing to me. and it's funny too, the tradition of fantasy that Dungeons and Dragons came out of isn't Tolkien and big epic fantasy. It's pulp Conan fantasy.
Right.
This kind of stuff where it's him, he gets together a crew, his team. He's got a wizard, a thief, Wilt Chamberlain is this ridiculous, gigantic, you know, I don't even know how tall he is, 7-foot warrior. Grace Jones is an Amazon. And they just go on an adventure to steal some stuff from a wizard and then defeat a monster. Like, it's really dumb, fun, pulp fantasy.
Yeah.
So check it out. It's an hour and a half. It's just pure popcorn. That's all it is. Cool. And it's fun.
Nice. Yeah.
So that's Conan the Barbarian and Conan the Destroyer. Stay tuned for Red Sonja, the final one, next right. episode.
And that's like a spinoff of the Conan movies. Does Schwarzenegger have a cameo in that movie? I feel like he might.
I saw him in the IMDb. I know he's in it. Red Sonja is another character in the Conan books and comics and stuff.
Gotcha.
And I think it's Brigitte Nielsen is Red Sonja. So, like, sure, why not? That'll be fun. Oh. I wanted to mention, I saw that there's a comic coming out in September that is Wonder Woman crossed over with Conan the Barbarian, where he ends up in Themyscira,
really?
Or like the DC Comics universe. And it's being written by Gail Simone, who has one of like the legendary Wonder Woman comic runs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so like it's going to be like a 4 or 5 issue, like just tiny little arc, and I'm really pumped for it. It'll just be really dumb and silly.
Nice. Yeah, very cool. So that's Conan the Barbarian, Conan the Destroyer, and then I have a few things I wanted to talk about. As always, it's my Twin Peaks discussion thread time. Episodes 7 and 8 of Twin Peaks have aired now. Episode they took a week off, so there's no episode 9 this week. It'll be next week.
They just skipped it up. Oh, because of the holiday.
Because of the holiday. Come on, man.
I was like, wait, what?
Anyway, so yeah, episodes 7 and 8 have aired. Once again, man, this show is truly amazing. You know, just when you think it has started to settle into a groove and becomes more like classic Twin Peaks than episode 7. Episode 7 is like, you know, it's starting to get to a place where it's like, oh, this is like becoming like classic Twin Peaks. I get this. I understand what's happening now.
Yeah.
Then episode 8,
plot.
Episode 8 comes around and it's like, nope. episode 8 of Twin Peaks, The Return, possibly the most unique experimental episode of TV I have ever seen. Not even possibly, almost definitely. It is like a lost cut of an Eraserhead TV series.
that's saying a lot, considering every episode before that is also that.
I know. Well, here's the thing. Like, you've seen the first 4 episodes, right?
The first 4, yeah.
Okay, so like, episodes 2 and 3 have like a lot of like crazy shit happening in them. And
yes, they do.
By the time you even get to episode 4, it starts to, it's still weird as shit, but it's like it's starting to mellow out a little bit, and it's kind of like falling into a groove, and it follows that groove for the next couple episodes, and like the next couple episodes are great. There's so much great stuff in those episodes. Like, do not misconstrue this as me saying those episodes are boring, because they are not.
Yeah.
They are incredible. But episode 2 and 3 like really have like these insane stuff of Cooper getting out of the Black Lodge and getting out of the Red Room, and so there's so much crazy stuff happening in that. And then in this episode, episode 8 blows that stuff out of the water. Like, in terms of the strange stuff you saw in that, in those two episodes, episode 8 will wreck you. there are images and moments in this episode that will haunt me forever.
Wow.
Like, once again, Twin Peaks, just unlike anything else in the history of TV, I truly think episode 8 will be a game changer for what TV as a medium is capable of. Like, people, like the fact that Showtime allowed this to exist, you know, that they just gave David Lynch a blank check and said, make something. And he's like, okay. it's truly amazing. And I would love to go into what happens in it, but you haven't seen it yet, so I don't want to spoil things for you. But I don't even know if it's like capable of being spoiled. Like, it's
that weird.
It is that weird. It is insane. So I really hope you catch up soon. I really want to talk about it with you. And you should do that at your earliest convenience. Maybe tonight is all I'm saying.
Who needs sleep?
Exactly. And then I do want to mention a couple of movies that I watched this past couple of weeks, which are nowhere near as good as episode 8 of Twin Peaks, but are still, this one is still pretty good.
Still worth mentioning.
Honestly, if I at the end of the year for my like top 10 list, like I will be hard pressed not to include episode 8 of Twin Peaks as like one of my favorite movies of the year.
I mean, you almost included the trailer for Fast 8 in your top in December, so I think you can do it.
That's true. Here's a couple of the movies I wanted to talk about. The first is The Beguiled, which is the new movie from Sofia Coppola, and it stars Colin Farrell, Nicole Kidman, Kirsten Dunst, and Elle Fanning. Have you heard anything about The Beguiled, Mike?
I have heard of it, but I haven't heard anything about it.
Okay, so yeah, this is the new movie from Sofia Coppola. It's a remake of the 1971 Don Siegel Clint Eastwood movie, The Beguiled, which I also watched a couple of weeks ago to prepare for this new one. And it's about a Union soldier during the Civil War who gets injured and takes refuge in a Confederate girls' school. In the original movie, that's Clint Eastwood, and this movie is Colin Farrell. And I think I prefer the original movie, but Coppola does, you know, just phenomenal work here. The movie looks incredible. Everything at least looks like it was shot with natural light, or at least it gives off that impression. There are several scenes that take place at night that are lit only by candles. And so it gives the movie like a really unique look to it. And every actor is just on their A game. There is this very pithy, subtle humor that I really enjoyed throughout. There's this like a lot of like passive aggression and snipes that are just very funny. Kirsten Dunst has one moment that's in like the background of a scene that made me laugh really, really hard. And it's not like it's a comedy, but like it's sort of like high. It's like a high melodrama, like camp almost. Mm-hmm. Not quite camp, but like it's like reaching it. It's like reaching it. And you know, it follows the same plot as the original movie, and it does exactly what the original movie does. But what's interesting about it is the original movie kind of mostly takes place from the perspective of Clint Eastwood's character. And so you see him cavorting around the girls' school, and like a lot of that movie is Clint Eastwood making out with different people for like 2 hours. Like it's
just Clint Eastwood stuff.
Yeah, and it's often very uncomfortable. And like the original movie is really interesting. It's like a very like odd vehicle for Clint Eastwood. Like it's very different than the other stuff he was making during that period, where he's making like cop dramas or westerns and stuff like that. This is like a very right. like, unique movie in Clint Eastwood's filmography, and I think they take that and they take that premise. But they focus on the women in this version, and that's Sofia Coppola's kind of take on it. And so Colin Farrell is in the Clint Eastwood role, but I wouldn't say he's the lead of the movie. It's kind of like he's incidental to the action around him. And so you're following mostly Nicole Kidman and Kirsten Dunst, but you're following the women around, like in the school, dealing with this kind of like intruder in the area. And so I think it's a really good movie. I think it's really interesting. And if you're a fan of Sofia Coppola, definitely check this out. And then I also saw 47 Meters Down, which is the new Shark Attack movie starring Mandy Moore and Claire Holt. It also stars Matthew Modine in a very supporting role
as the shark.
It's directed by Johannes Roberts, and this is a movie about two women who go in a shark cage, and then it snaps, sending them down to the surface of the water with limited air left and surrounded by sharks. So they're at the bottom of the ocean. For what it is, it's fine. Like there are a couple of thrills to be had. It pales in comparison to The Shallows, which is a similar movie from last year, which I really, really enjoyed. And I think you should watch at some point, Mike.
When I finish my fantasy list and I move on to shark movies,
which is the next list you have, I'm sure.
Yes.
It does, however, feature what could have been a really great twist. If they had just ended the movie like 60 seconds earlier, like if they had stuck to it, it was so close. And it chickens out at the last minute. So we get kind of like a limp ending to a kind of limp movie. But there is, you know, some solid like scares. The people in my, like what made it more fun is that the people in my theater were like screaming. I was in a relatively packed theater for 47 Meters Down. Which I was surprised about, for sure. But people were, like, screaming and, like, freaking out throughout the whole movie. Like, it was kind of entertaining. I also saw The Beguiled in a hugely packed theater. Like, it was The Beguiled I saw in a nearly sold-out theater. And I was shocked. it was an audience that was mostly, like, middle-aged women. And also me. Which happens a lot, because I go to see a lot of movies, and so, you know, but still, it was a very odd experience. So 47 Meters Down, not great, has some solid thrills, but it does have the potential for a really great twist at the end, and it kind of chickens out at the last minute. And I'll tell you about that. I don't want to spoil it, so I'll tell you about it during the break, but I do want to discuss that with you, because it is really funny. And then finally, I just wanted to throw this out there. I watched Ouija, Origin of Evil, which is the new movie directed by Mike Flanagan, came out last year. It's the new horror movie that's a sequel to 2014's Ouija. And I just wanted to throw it out there. Ouija 2, dope as hell. And I couldn't even make it through the first Ouija. I watched like 20 minutes of Ouija 1 and was like, I can't do this. This is really boring. Ouija 1 is really bad. Ouija 2 is really fun. It's Mike Flanagan's the guy who directed Hush. And he is, I think he's making something else. He was going to be making Halloween. That didn't end up panning out. But he made Hush. He made Oculus and a couple other things. And he is a really cool horror director that I'm really into. And he ends up doing Ouija Origin of Evil. And this is a prequel to the first Ouija that takes place in the 70s. And so you have like that kind of like 70s set atmosphere going for it. And it's like old school creeps and ghouls. And it's just really fun and really funny. And it's just a really entertaining horror movie. So watch it. It's great. Ouija 2. You wouldn't expect Ouija 2 to be good.
Hot take.
Yeah. Speaking of, there's another horror prequel that is the sequel. There's a horror prequel that is the second movie to a horror movie that came out in 2014.
You can get there. That
should I start over? There is a horror prequel coming out this year that is the second movie to a movie that came out in 2014. That I'm also very interested in, if you've seen the trailer. Annabelle Creation is coming out this year.
It's not where I thought you were going with that.
Well, Annabelle Creation, I didn't see the first Annabelle. I heard it was really bad. You saw Annabelle, right?
It did, yeah.
Yeah, I've heard it's not...
I don't even remember.
Yeah, I've heard it's very bad. But Annabelle Creation is from the guy who did Lights Out. And I think this it might be like a Ouija 2 all over again, where it's like, oh, maybe if we just take the horror movies that are bad, attach a pretty good director to them, and make them prequels.
retroactively make the movie good.
Yeah, it's quite a trend that's going on here. So anyway, Ouija 2, really dope. Definitely recommend. And The Beguiled and 47 Meters Down and Twin Peaks. So, well, it's just disregard everything I said and watch Twin Peaks is basically basically where
I'm never going. Go to the movies again. Stay home and only watch Twin Peaks. Got it.
Well, I will let you go to the movies for one thing, and that is Baby Driver, which we'll talk about right now.
You've been my driver for every job since we met. You're the best in the business. I'm gonna need you behind the wheel again.
One more job and I'm done.
One more job and we're straight.
Why is he listening to music all the time?
He had an accident when he was a kid.
Got mental problems?
I'm the one who got the mental problems in the crew. Position taken.
What is your name?
Baby.
Your name's Baby. B-A-B-Y, Baby.
In this business. The moment you catch feelings is the moment you catch a bullet.
All right, that was from the trailer for Baby Driver, the new movie directed by Edgar Wright. It stars Ansel Elgort, Kevin Spacey, John Hamm, Jamie Foxx, Lily James, Aiza Gonzalez, and John Bernthal, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Baby Driver reads, after being coerced into working for a crime boss, a young getaway driver finds himself taking part in a heist doomed to fail. So, Mike, every movie that Edgar Wright has made up to this point is among my favorite movies of all time. And that sounds like an exaggeration, but it is not. Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, The World's End. These are movies that I can watch over and over again. I still find something new each time I watch them. It is insane how detailed these movies are. They are remarkable pieces of work. And to say I was excited for Baby Driver, it's kind of an understatement.
Yeah.
So, Mike, I mean, yeah, what is your relationship with the work of Edgar Wright? Were you excited for Baby Driver before going into this?
I was very excited. I don't know if I, you know what, I might as well put him in my favorite of all time. I don't know. Why not? I definitely, Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz are definitely up there. I have only seen At World's End, The World's End, the classic two movies coming out near each other that are similar titles. But yeah, The World's End, I have only seen once or twice, so I don't have as much affinity for it. As I do the other two in the Cornetto trilogy, that doesn't mean it's bad. I just haven't seen it as much. Scott Pilgrim vs. the World is incredible also. And he's one of those directors that does one of the things that I love the most, where it is his fingerprints, his style, his DNA is in all of his movies, and he does not shy away from it, which explains a lot with Ant-Man, right? As we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Shocker that he's going to make the movie he wants to make. So and it just so happens that I love that style, right? The thing that he does appeals to me very much, on top of it being a thing in general that I love when directors do. So yeah, I was definitely excited for Baby Driver to see an Edgar Wright heist getaway driver movie. Like, just that sentence is enough, and then what delivers is another plane. Yeah. What we get to watch on the screen.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, I love the hook behind this movie, which is that Baby, the driver, the titular Baby Driver. The hook behind this movie is that Baby has tinnitus, and so he plays music to drown out the ringing in his ears. And so everything in this movie is scored to whatever the music is that Baby is listening to at any given time.
Right.
And I loved Baby Driver so much, man. It is cool as hell. It's incredible to watch. Features some of the best set pieces that I feel like I'll see in movies all year. It's a lot like if Edgar Wright expanded the Don't Stop Me Now scene from Shaun of the Dead into a feature film. And it is glorious.
Make that the whole movie. And it's amazing.
Yeah. But yeah, so what were your overall thoughts on Baby Driver, man?
I had heard before I had seen the movie that it was toes the line between a musical and a heist movie, and I wasn't really sure what to make of that going in. And what we really get is basically a rock opera for all intents and purposes, as far as I'm concerned. And it's so much fun. The right from go, the music is at 11, and we're just in it. And it has some of the pulpiest dialogue in a movie that I've seen in a very long time.
Yes.
And it is so much fun because of it. That's a thing that I love. Kevin Spacey yelling, "Shop, let's talk it," is so silly. Like, that's such a silly thing that a human would say.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. I can't sing this movie's praises enough.
Yeah. You can't. Yeah. It's really incredible. And the soundtrack of this movie is almost like the star, like it's almost the star of the film. And I downloaded the soundtrack this past weekend. It's 30 songs on the soundtrack. It is an hour and 43 minutes, which is almost as long as the movie itself is, which is also insane. Like, normally, a soundtrack album will be, about an hour or so. Like, it's, you know.
Yeah.
And this movie, but that shows, every scene in this movie is scored to some kind of song or whatever tune. And a lot of it is, instrumental songs that are just kind of, play in the background and stuff. But, so many set pieces are, perfectly timed to the music that is playing corresponding to that set piece, and it's beautiful to watch. It is just a blast, and right from the beginning, Edgar Wright is just so confident in what he's doing that he can start this movie with a song that probably 90% of the audience isn't gonna know. He starts off with that song by John Spencer Blues Explosion, Bell Bottoms, and he's gonna trust that they'll be along for the ride anyway. They'll just be into it, and I for one very much am, and it seems like most people are. This movie's gotten insane critical acclaim. All his movies always get critical acclaim. People always like his movies. This one got a 90 something on Rotten Tomatoes, 97 or something, something super high. But also, it's getting it's doing pretty well financially, which never happens for Edgar Wright movies.
Yeah, he almost always makes a cult movie.
Yeah, almost always. And I think this will end up being a cult movie where people will obsess over it and watch it over and over again. As all of his movies end up being, Scott Pilgrim was a huge bomb at the box office. That movie didn't make any money at all. And, even Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and The World's End, those are movies that, people really love, and usually do pretty well in Britain, but in America, they do not make a ton of money. And that's a huge bummer to me because they are some of the cleverest movies that have ever existed. You know? So I'm very happy that Baby Driver is making the money it's making because it finally gives Edgar Wright a win that he can use to launch into his next thing, which I'm all about because I want more Edgar Wright. It always takes so long for Edgar Wright movies to get made.
Yeah.
And I want more. I want them more now in my eyeballs.
I think this is the movie that will launch him into full-blown. He's already a pretty influential director in some fashion, I think. But I think he'll just be able to do whatever he wants from now on.
Yeah, hopefully. That is the goal. What I do also really like about this movie is that it's anchored by the relationship between Baby and Deborah, played by Lily James. And I really think that works in the movie's favor. I was watching it. I saw the movie twice. I actually just got out of it an hour ago the second time. And, I was watching it and, looking at Baby and Deborah's relationship, and I feel like I'm so in from the beginning with them. And I'm not sure why, because logically there isn't much between them, you know? I feel like just the two of them, together, they only have a couple of scenes together, and, it's mostly just, pretty people smiling at each other. And, so logically I feel like, where they go to by the end of this movie, it shouldn't logically make sense, but this is also a story that's told through its music, and music doesn't work logically, it works emotionally. And I found myself incredibly invested in them, pretty much from the beginning, and especially by the end. I was so invested in them that I was fighting back tears towards the end. Maybe not that intense, but I was very moved by the end of this movie, and I think part of that is the soundtrack doing a lot of the work for it, but also I feel like Lily James and Ansel Elgort have such an easy chemistry together. They're two very likable people, and those characters are. Kind of blank slates, but the blank kind of blank slate that it's sort of an emotional connection rather than something that I have to think about too much. And so I really enjoyed that about the movie.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how this movie wears its influences or it blasts its influences through the speakers at 11 the whole movie, right? It is so open about what it is trying and wants to do, the pulpy dialogue, the crazy movie or music, The car chases and the action are great. And I think, you know, that line that I want to get in a car that I can't afford with a plan I don't have and just drive. Like, that's there's every Bruce Springsteen song is that. Like, it's you know what I mean? Like, it's not trying to do I don't want to say it's not trying to be original because it is, but it's just going headlong into its influences like that. I mean, they're a Bonnie and Clyde, a Thelma and Louise, all these kinds of, you know, crime duo things. And they directly call them that when they steal one of the cars at some point. Somebody's like, oh, look at Bonnie and Clyde or whatever.
Bonnie and Bonnie, I think is what
Bonnie and Bonnie, yeah.
Yeah. I like that you mentioned the Bruce Springsteen, like you say that sounds like a Bruce Springsteen line, because there is like a lyrical quality to a lot of the stuff that happens in this movie. Yeah. Specifically a lot of the dialogue. I was watching, I feel like once again, like Edgar Wright has made a movie that I'm going to rewatch so many times and pick up on so many new things every time.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I noticed, during the tequila scene, and I'm going to be as vague as possible because I feel like even saying songs that are in the movie almost feels like a spoiler. There's a scene during the tequila that there's a bit where John Hamm and Jamie Foxx are talking during the tequila scene. And a lot of the dialogue, like it feels like a regular conversation, but a lot of it rhymes.
Yeah.
And so I like in that way, I feel like it's like there's a lyrical quality to it that like it flows with the song. And I was reading about how Edgar Wright made the movie, and like I was listening to a podcast about how Edgar Wright made the movie, and like he was talking about how he would just play the music all the time on the set and like have the actors like listening to the songs, like they have like earbuds in and are listening to the song as they're speaking. And so they are speaking in tune with the song as they're acting, and it's kind of insane to watch in the movie. It's pretty great.
Yeah, I mean it's not tequila. The tequila scene is not. Oh, I don't know. I don't want to say so. But I mean, just so much of the movie is done, like you said. Just not only their acting, but so much of the action and stuff that's happening on screen is in beat in time with, you know, even down in time with the song that's playing currently, down to Kevin Spacey counting out stacks of money, gunshots, all this stuff is to the time and beat of the music, which is why I put it in the rock opera category. Like, it's the music is so much a part of the fabric of the movie.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And we should talk about the supporting cast of this movie, which, you know, includes John Hamm, Kevin Spacey, Jamie Foxx. All of them are great. I think this is, like, probably John Hamm's best performance since Mad Men ended, which was... Granted, only like 2 years ago, but it feels like a really long time because Mad Men was pretty great. Also, I think it's Kevin Spacey's best performance before House of Cards started.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's Jamie Foxx's best performance since Django Unchained. Though I haven't watched Beat Shazam yet, so.
What? Wait.
Jamie Foxx hosting a game show called Beat Shazam where...
oh, yeah, yes, yes.
So
yeah.
I mean, he could be putting great work into Beat Shazam. I don't know. I think it is his best thing since Django came out, which is pretty cool. And there's just this, like, pervading sense of cool, like, throughout this movie with, like, just the right amount of, like, genuine emotion. I feel like it stands apart from other action films in that way. Like, it doesn't have the kind of, like, macho posturing that... a lot of other action movies, for example, the Fast and Furious movies or like XXX3, right. Anything with Vin Diesel in it.
You know, the only action movies.
The only kind of action movies that get made are Vin Diesel movies. Everyone knows that. it doesn't have that kind of like macho posturing throughout, which, you know, I love the macho posturing. I'm a big fan of that. I'm a huge action movie aficionado. You know, this feels like Ansel Elgort is not your typical action hero. You know,
no.
And so I feel like the movie leans into that, and Edgar Wright can shoot that action like nobody's business. You know, he's incredible at action scenes. It's one of the big things. Like all of his movies up to this point have been comedies, but they've also been action movies. You know, especially like Hot Fuzz is one of the best action movies of the decade. Like it's it's like not even close. And like Scott Pilgrim has incredible action sequences. The World's End is incredible action sequences. Like there's so much good stuff in there. And so much of that has to do with the editing and just the quick insert shots. And like there's a lot of one takes and the audio work is all like superb. And that's all present here. And it's just awesome. So this is less of a comedy and more of a straight action film than anything else Edgar Wright has done. And yet it's still funnier than most other movies that exist.
Yeah. I'll also, drop in a plug. I've talked about it before for Every Frame of Painting, the YouTube channel.
Right.
One of the video essays is on Edgar Wright and his use of action in comedy. And it's really incredible and awesome. So check it out. And yeah, this is, it's an action movie, but that's also one of the, like you just said, one of the funniest movies that's come out in a very long time.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. The whole thing just made me incredibly giddy. Like, I was... when I woke up the day, it was June 28th, day after my birthday. It was the day that Baby Driver was being released. And
in your dreams, Edgar Wright said, "Happy birthday, Mike."
Exactly. Here's a movie. I woke up that morning, June 28th, and realized that that night I was going to go see a new Edgar Wright movie, and got so excited that while I was at work, I was like shaking. and that's not something that happens to me anymore that much. You know, it's like, I have always been a huge fan of movies. And so occasionally, you know, that might happen every once in a while, but like, I don't get so excited about a movie that like I'm physically shaking. That used to happen sometimes. Like, there was like in middle school or high school, like I would get so excited about something that would like feel like it would feel like forever that I had to wait for The Dark Knight to come out or something, you know?
Right.
And now it's like, I watch so many movies, and there's so many movies that I still want to see that it's like, I can just, you know, it's fine. I'll see War for the Planet of the Apes when it comes out, and I don't have to worry about when it's like, I have plenty of movies to watch in the meantime.
Yeah.
You know, I'm excited for it, sure. But like with Baby Driver, like I woke up that morning, I was like, holy shit, I'm seeing a new Edgar Wright movie tonight. I'm seeing fucking Baby Driver. And I was like physically like, holy shit, this is really happening. And then after the movie ended, I was shaking again because of all like the adrenaline.
it's just that good.
Yeah, it is a straight shot of like pure Edgar Wright. And it's pretty incredible. So, Mike, do you have anything else you wanted to add before we move on to spoilers, or should we do that?
No, I think we pretty much covered it. We should head into spoilers.
All right, let's do that. Let's move on into spoilers for Baby Driver, starting right now. All right, spoilers for Baby Driver, starting right now. Mike, if all this movie accomplishes is getting people to realize how fucking awesome Brighton Rock by Queen is, then it's all worth it, you know.
Edgar Wright just loves his Queen.
He like, does. What do you? Yeah, exactly. So that was pretty great. I really liked how they played John Hamm's character Buddy, who starts off as like Baby's sort of ally.
Right.
Like he has a scene where he and Baby are listening to Brighton Rock together, like they're listening to the earbuds. Even in that like opening chase scene, like, you know, there's Baby like doing his car chase things, and he is able to evade the cops, and Buddy like kind of pats him on the shoulder like, "It's good job," and he's like smiling and laughing like he's having a great time. And so I think it makes the film's reveal that he is the ultimate threat that Baby faces and not Jamie Foxx that much more impactful, and I like that quite a bit.
Yeah, the as we mentioned earlier, the supporting cast in this is great. Buddy and Darling and Bats. It's just, they're so much fun. Those characters are so silly. I love those kind of, the criminal underworld type character, you know, when we do in these heist movies and stuff. And in Edgar Wright, those things are so heightened to just the comedic, versions of them.
Absolutely.
Like Flea playing No-Nose.
Eddie No-Nose.
who's always referred to our friend with a nasal problem. Like, it's so cheesy, but beautiful.
Yes, I mean that was a great line when they get introduced, like, as Eddie No Nose, formerly Eddie the Nose, and yeah, and it's like, how did you lose your nose? And it's like, that's No Nose Nose, man. That's just...
yeah. And I love too. I was just thinking about it earlier that I always say John. Like, is it John or Jay Bernthal? I can never remember.
Oh, John Bernthal.
John Bernthal. Who is in this movie for, you know, 15 minutes, and he's great. Scene when he's slapping the sunglasses off Baby, and he keeps just pulling out more sunglasses is hilarious. But, as he exits the movie as well, if you never see me again, I'm probably dead. And then he's never back in the movie, so he's probably dead.
He's probably dead.
It's just a great... I don't know why that that hit me earlier today, but I was just like, you know, getting ready for the podcast, and was like, oh shit, I guess he's dead. I don't know.
Yeah, that was pretty great. And yeah, I mean, just there's so much like fun, like just so much fun dialogue in this movie. During that scene where he's introducing Eddie No-Nose, he also introduced a guy named JD, and Kevin Spacey says like, he puts the Asian in Home Invasion. it's like a perfect like pulpy line. Like, it's so good. I gotta talk about some of the sequences in this movie. There's the one take sequence of Baby getting coffee towards the beginning to the tune of Harlem Shuffle.
The Edgar Wright one take.
The Edgar Wright one take. It's incredible, man. Because there's, like, I'm assuming you caught this too. Like, the graffiti and stuff on throughout the site. Mm-hmm. It's showing the lyrics to the song as they come up. And it's insane. Like, he's just walking through. And it makes the city, like, this movie takes place in Atlanta. It makes the city of Atlanta feel alive. Like, it makes it feel like I've never been to Atlanta, but I feel like I've been there now. Because of that. Like, it is really incredible. Like, he's just walking through, and, like, if the word yeah appears in the song, then the word yeah will appear in graffiti on the wall. Or he'll, like, stop and, like, make a pose that looks exactly like the pose that the graffiti behind him is making. There'll be a sticker that says, like, you know, stick to the left or whatever as that shows up, and, like, you know, he'll imitate a trumpet in front of, like, a store that's selling a trumpet. And
yeah. I mean, that scene, when that moment culminates, when he walks into the coffee shop and the guy's like, oh, can I get you anything? And he sings, yeah, yeah, yeah. Or says, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Over in the time song, singing, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's fucking great.
Oh, it was so good. And yeah, so that was incredible. The opening chase scene, set to Bell Bottoms by the John Spencer Blues Experience. That's really great. I think it's just a perfect introduction to that character too, to Baby, and to his whole deal. Like, he's just, like, listening to the Bell Bottom song, and it's perfectly edited too. Like, you know, you hear the first guitar riff and it cuts to Baby, and then you hear the second guitar riff and it cuts to John Hamm, and you hear the third guitar beat and it cuts to John Bernthal, and it's like, just it's just so cool. Like,
yeah, that's really the whole thing.
Yeah, and then, you know, you see Baby dancing to the song as the bank robbery is going down, and he's just imitate, like, mouthing along with the lyrics, and he's like, ladies and gentlemen, I gotta tell you right now about the John Spencer Blues or about the Bell Bottoms, and it's so much fun. And the actual chase is incredible. Like, it's just so much, it's so cool. There's so many weaving in and out, like, and all these stunts are mostly, like, pretty much really being done. There's very little CGI in this movie. Like, these are, like, Edgar Wright wanted to commit to making a real car chase movie, and so the result is that you don't get the outlandish stuff that happens in a Fast and Furious movie, which is fun, which is great in its own right. You know, I love the Fast and Furious movies. I've talked about that in the past.
Huh? I would have never guessed, Frank.
But, you know, this movie, it creates a sense of reality, and there's a greater sense of danger to what's happening. And, like, you know, those are real people in real cars that are really doing all this crazy shit, and it's pretty wild. And I think my favorite thing in that sequence, that first opening chase, is when Baby finds two other red cars that look exactly like his car, and just weaves in the middle of them, and then is able to maneuver his way around them under a tunnel, and so they, like, throws the cops off. That was a brilliant, a brilliant thing happening there.
It's a really great, on top of, you know, being a really great car chase and a really fun action sequence, it's such a good establishing car chase to show us what Baby's capable of for all of the crazy shit that happens later in the movie that he has to react to.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's the second car chase, which is set to Neat, Neat, Neat by the Damned, which features hilarious Mike Myers masks.
Yep. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but that moment when he starts the music, but then Jamie Foxx gives his little pep talk speech, and he's like, "Wait, I gotta start over," because you know, the music is so important to him, the rhythm of it all.
Yes, and I was listening to I was actually reading an article about Edgar Wright, like, he was talking about some of the scenes in this movie, and the reason that happens is because the song was too short for the scene. So.
Oh my God.
So Edgar Wright decided, like, wait, oh, this could be a cool character thing for Baby, and also this could fix my problem.
And it makes the song the perfect length.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So that was pretty fantastic. And yeah, it does have those hilarious Mike Myers masks, where I think it's JD is, like, the incompetent dude who, like, they're supposed to be wearing Michael Myers Halloween masks, and he pulls out, like, a mask, and it's like, what is this? It's Austin Powers.
It's like, it is a Halloween mask.
It's like, you're supposed to get Mike Myers. This is Mike Myers. No, Michael Myers from the movie Halloween. Oh, you mean Jason? No.
And it's just Edgar Wright. It's so good. His writing in this movie is amazing.
Yeah, it's very, very sharp. And also, like, I think there's a lot of care being taken into the fact that we should be invested in Baby as a good person, even though he's doing really, like, horrible, like, criminal acts.
He doesn't want to be there.
Yeah, and so, you know, throughout the movie, like, there are several, like, in that car chase scene, they have to hijack another car, and they kick this woman out of her car, and she has a baby, and Baby, like, takes care of, like pulls the infant out of the car and hands it to her, and, like, that whole thing, and he takes care to toss away Jamie Foxx's gun when he's about to shoot the dude who's chasing them. By the way, that dude who is chasing them, and gets that sequence where that dude is like hitting them with his car, and the car like swerves and they get caught under a truck.
Yeah,
his truck is just going. Was awesome. Like that was just super cool. I feel like this whole review is like, man, that was awesome. That was so cool.
I mean, it is though. I mean, we should probably refrain from just doing the whole movie play by play because we're sort of doing that. Because all of it's great, and we want to talk about every scene.
All right. Well, we're in spoilers, so it's like, wait,
we are. It's
fine. It's whatever. I also wanted to talk about the foot chase set to Hocus Pocus by Focus.
Yes.
Which was, I think, arguably the best scene in the movie. Like, watching it the second time was...
I was going to say, I think it's my favorite sequence chase throughout the movie. And I think only, well, not only, it is incredible, but because the song is Hocus Pocus by Focus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hocus Pocus by Focus, because I always get that mixed up. That song is like a weird in joke with a couple of my old roommates and I, where, yeah, because it's a silly, crazy, shreddy prog rock song that has a yodel breakdown. So we would always play it as a joke to each other. So when I heard the organ in the beginning, I was like, no, are they really going to use this song? And then it happened, and they play the whole song, and it's incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible, and it's so perfect. Like it's
it's so silly.
Yeah, it is fantastic. And that whole I feel like once, like, I was really enjoying the movie up to that point. Like, I was really into it. Like at that point, I would say it's a great movie. And then as soon as Hocus Pocus kicks in, and it's like a half hour left of the movie at that point. From there on out, it is transcendent. Like, I think it is. Like, it is nonstop fucking incredible as soon as Hocus Pocus kicks in. Because that's right when Jamie Foxx's character dies, when Bats dies.
Right.
And when Baby, like, finally takes agency and just straight up murders Bats by ramming him, like just driving the car straight into a truck that has a girder that is out
he,
there.
He final destinations him.
He final destinations him. He washed from Serenities. Bats, and it's surprising and it's brutal and it's fucking awesome. It's so,
yeah.
Like, both times I saw the movie, like, I could hear people in my theater gasp when that happened. Like, it's so cool. And then as soon as that happens, that's when Hocus Pocus kicks in and there's that whole foot chase. And you know, there's so many like obstacles that like there's so much care that goes into that. Like, you got to imagine all the shit that Edgar Wright thought of just for like that one sequence, and then realize he had to do it for every sequence in this movie.
It's wild. I mean, the choreography throughout the whole movie is transcendent. Is a very good word.
It's just next level, level stuff. But yeah, Hocus Pocus was a great track for that, and just I just love hearing that yodeling breakdown in the middle of the movie, like yodel, no, 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 no.
It's perfect.
It's great. Also, the tequila scene, I wanted to mention that because I think that's the moment that's most easily identifiable as the one where everything is like synced up perfectly to the song.
Yeah.
it's kind of insane, but like you'll hear like the machine guns and they'll be like to the drum beat and like you know, they're firing in tandem with the song. And you know, it's a perfect song for the way, like, just the way it ends with the grenade exploding the building. It's like tequila.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
So that was awesome and really great. And also the incredible climax of the movie with Brighton Rock by Queen playing as John Hamm and Baby are finally like facing off against each other, and it's pretty wild, man. It is a wild ride.
Yeah.
And John Hamm just would not die for a long time.
This had a point to prove.
Yeah. Other scenes you want to talk about, Mike? Anything else you wanted to mention? Like, I feel like there's so much other any other song choices that you thought were pretty cool.
Mostly all of them is right. The issue. what did you think of the ending, the culmination of Baby surrendering to the police, and we get the montage of his court or right. his trial and him in prison and all that?
Yeah, I thought that was great. I loved that because it kind of like emphasizes that, like, yeah, like it kind of brings us back down to the point where we intellectually know Baby has done some horrible shit.
Especially in that last act.
Especially in that last act. And so we know he can't just get off like scot-free. Like, you know, there's a lot he has to reckon for. But we also know that Baby is a good-hearted person who it has done a lot of like good things too, and I think the movie recognizes that, and so he does serve some jail time. But there's a montage of people at the court, and like, you know, Deborah talks about how they wanted to be more than friends, and how she thinks he's a good-hearted person, and like that you'll see the person who he jacked a car from, but like gave her purse back. And like his foster dad will be like, he never wanted to be in on this. And like there's a lot of people at to baby's defense. And so he ends up serving, I guess, 5 years in prison. And then, he picks up right where he left off with Deborah, apparently, as the movie, kind of implies towards the end.
In this like weird Pleasantville, like in black and white that fades back to color thing. Yes. Great.
Yeah, it is beautiful. Just magical. And then it ends, of course, with Baby Driver by Simon and Garfunkel. Which I assume the movie was named after.
I guess, yeah. Or it was a really weird coincidence.
Now you're right. It was just like, oh, hey, look at this.
Yeah, neat.
but yeah, like it's so much fun, man. I had so much fun watching Baby Driver both times. I look forward to watching it many, many more times. Because it's just Edgar Wright, man. I can't stop watching his stuff. I just get obsessed and I feel like I'm at a loss for words at this point, because all I've been saying is this is fucking great, but it is pretty fucking great.
It is.
Yeah. One last shout out to Kevin Spacey, who is pretty great in this movie and has some hilarious lines. Specifically, there's one line that Baby Driver says a couple times where he says he says to Kevin Spacey, he's like, nothing is more important than our friendship. We're a team. And which is a line that he picked up from Monsters, Inc. earlier in the movie. Like, he was just like flipping through channels and that line is on.
Yeah.
But there's also, and so he says it to Kevin Spacey towards the end, and Kevin Spacey just snaps and he's like, stop quoting lines from Monsters, Inc. to me. It pisses me off.
Yeah, I do love another thing to point out that, you know, we mentioned that Edgar Wright one take of a person leaving a building, walking to a store to buy something and coming back, which I think has been in all of his movies, or at least in the Cornetto trilogy.
Yeah, it's definitely in Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah, it happens in Hot Fuzz, I think.
Okay. Yeah, it probably does happen in Hot Fuzz movies. And that will be something that I notice upon the next rewatch, I'm sure.
Yeah. And then the flipping through the TV that is making complete sentences while...
Yeah.
Which is hilarious. It's so good. Yes,
yeah. And actually, I mean, they do the Monsters, Inc. line. They also do, I think it's a line from It's Complicated. There's like John Krasinski. I think it's John Krasinski and Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
And John Krasinski says, like, they grow up so freaking fast, don't they? And then later on, Baby says that to the post office worker.
Yeah.
And so I think that's interesting. And I would be interested in rewatching it a third time to see if the other lines from that montage get thrown out at some point, because I think that would be kind of cool. Any other thoughts about Baby Driver you wanted to throw out there, Mike, before we should wrap this up?
Just go see it. I mean, that's it.
That's all
we can't.
Is.
We can't say more.
That's all there is. It's so good. Edgar Wright, master of the form. He's just so good. I will probably end up rewatching the other four Edgar Wright movies in the near future. And I started rewatching Spaced recently. Have you seen Spaced?
No.
Okay.
It's been on my list for a while.
Spaced is one of the best shows ever, naturally. Because Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
Right. But, what more could you need?
Yeah, it's also one of the nerdiest shows ever. Like, one of the geekiest shows ever made. So you should definitely watch it when you get a chance. I have it on DVD, so at some point we should just watch it. But
yeah.
Anyway, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. And plus, I have some work at crookedscoreboard.com. You can check that out, too. Thank you so much for listening to FilmBookCast. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DiCriscio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're in about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, it's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now, join us in 2 weeks where we're either going to be discussing one of two movies. Mike, you're going to have to make this call right now. Spider-Man Homecoming, War for the Planet of the Apes.
Don't put this evil on me, Mike. You can't do that to a person.
We got to do one of them. And yeah, it's a tough choice. Maybe both. If we can see,
if we see both,
I mean, I'll end up seeing both.
Whoa. Yeah, that's a fair thing to say. I'm going to pick Spider-Man. Let's do Spider-Man. Because okay. We can't ever give up a chance to talk about Marvel for an hour and a half, Mike.
That's also very much true. So, yeah. Okay. Almost, Spider-Man, Homecoming, and then I'll probably end up talking about War of the Planet of the Apes quite a bit. If you don't, if you can see War of the Planet of the Apes, we'll do like a double review.
Yeah.
But Spider-Man, Homecoming, for sure. That's definitely happening.
That's the one.
And you can check out our next Complete Works, where we're going to be talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2004's National Treasure. So pretty stoked to talk about that one, Mike. That's been a while since I've seen that, and looking forward to revisiting it.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much for listening. We are out.